The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning. I'm Richard Gordon.
I'm Allie Delaney.
On Campus Voices today, we have Professor Christine Heyerman, who's the Robert W. and Shirley P. Grimble Professor of American History here at the University of Delaware, and she specializes in early American social and cultural history, and her books include Commerce and Culture, about the maritime communities of colonial Massachusetts, Southern Cross, about the origins of the Bible Belt, and 2015's American Apostles, about the early encounters between American evangelical Christians and the Islamic world. And American Apostles won the 2016 Francis Parkman Prize. Welcome, Professor Heyerman.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Professor Heyerman, how did you get your start as a historian?
I got my start as an historian in the office of one of my professors when I was in college. It was my coming on my last semester of college. I was planning to teach high school, and I had a conversation with this male professor back in 1970. Who told me that he thought I was pretty smart and maybe I could get into graduate school. And so I applied to graduate school and I got in. I had an inspirational professor there who was an early Americanist. That's how I became an historian.
What excited you about the field?
Well, I had always been interested in history. And the truth is that I was undecided about what field I wanted to study. And just by accident, I ended up doing the first half of American history because I admired the man who became my mentor so much. So entirely by accident, here I am.
Now we fast forward to 2001, and you had an incident that inspired you to start the project that became American Apostles.
Yes, this was an unfortunate incident. This was the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And my husband at the time was a civilian employee in the Pentagon. And when the plane hit the Pentagon, he told me that he was sitting in a desk chair that had wheels on it. And the impact threw him from one end of the room to the other. And he called me on his way out the door of the office, left a message saying that they had a little excitement at the Pentagon. Those were his exact words. And then I didn't hear from him for several hours thereafter until he finally found a Chinese restaurant with a telephone and assured me he was okay. He got the last train that left Washington, D.C. They were shutting everything down, all the communications, all the transportation. And I picked him up at BWI Airport, the Amtrak station there, on this beautiful, serene September afternoon, and rubbing my eyes still at our good fortune, because, of course, there were so many people who died in those attacks. But an even greater horror to our way of thinking followed with the attack on Islam, the surge of Islamophobia that followed the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And I was working on another book project entirely, but I couldn't stop thinking about this, what a betrayal of American values, our commitment to religious liberty it was, that politicians, for purely self-interested reasons, were victimizing Muslims. And I started wondering where this strain of Islamophobia might be coming from in the American past. I was just so angry. That was what carried me through this project. I knew nothing about Islam or, you know, no more than the person on the street when I got started. So it took me a long time. But, you know, I felt that I had written a book in the end that, that spoke to the issues of the present day.
Sounds like you had a historian's gut level response of let's go find out what's behind this. That led you back to, you know, late 18th century and early 19th century America.
That's, well, you know, that you're absolutely right. It's a real historian's habit of thought when something happens in the present to tell oneself, you know, if I could just understand how this got started, maybe there would be some way of making the present better to understand the origins of any phenomenon.
So talking about the way it got started, what was America like after the War of 1812?
Well, one can say in general about the period between the Revolution and the mid-1820s that in terms of the religious orientation of the new United States, this is a period in which evangelical Protestantism, which was then much as it is today in terms of its general theology, its ideas of the relationship between God and man, that evangelical Protestantism is on the ascent. And really what happens over the whole course of the 19th century is that evangelical Protestantism comes to dominate politics and culture in the United States to an unprecedented degree. And what surprised me particularly in the course of doing this book is the extent to which Americans, especially before the Civil War, got their information about the rest of the world through evangelical Protestant media. And among the most important informants telling Americans what the rest of the world was like, what other cultures were like, were the first generations of foreign missionaries, who were all of them coming from the United States, evangelical Protestants. There is no foreign correspondent reporting to newspapers in the United States before 1840. There's no such thing as a foreign correspondent. And so news from abroad is coming either from a handful of consuls and ambassadors scattered very thinly throughout the world, and these missionaries who are stationed in the Middle East, in West Africa, in what we call today Sri Lanka, what was then Ceylon, in India, in China, in what was called the Sandwich Islands, today known as Hawaii. So to a remarkable extent, pre-Civil War Americans are dependent on missionaries and the reports that they send in to evangelical publications, many of which get reprinted in secular newspapers, for their information about the rest of the world.
It really is interesting because it's hard for some of us to think, isn't it, Allie, about what life was like pre-photography, pre-radio, pre-TV, pre-internet.
Exactly, exactly.
So what kinds of things fascinated their readers?
Well, the big surprise for me getting into the subject was the interest that Americans very early in the 19th century had about Islam. There are any number of books covering Islam, covering customs of the Middle East generally, covering the life of Muhammad, that turn up in the very well-patronized lending libraries of the period. And even more striking, because it would have reached even more people, is the extent of coverage of Islamic culture and belief in American newspapers and magazines. And some of this coverage was wildly inaccurate. Some of it editorialized about Islam in a very negative way, caricatured Islam. But what really struck me was how much of it there was and how much of it made a sincere attempt to understand Islam accurately and to represent it fairly. And that was made easier because starting in the 17th century and then really going up to the present, of course, but for our purposes, going through the early 19th century, there are a number of Westerners, Western Christians, influenced by the Enlightenment, who were pursuing Islam as a serious scholarly subject, and who were particularly interested in writing about Muhammad, the great prophet of Islam, in a dispassionate way. And there are, dating from the 17th century, very admiring biographies of Islam, praising him, as you would expect from enlightened Westerners, because he was a person who approached religion as they saw it through the use of reason, and who was a committed monotheist. And his monotheism was seen as exemplifying what a reasonable man he was. So he's praised as this enlightened thinker. He is praised as a lawgiver, as an inspired legislator. So the whole image of Muhammad during these centuries undergoes in the West a total makeover. And in Americans early in the 19th century, they are fascinated by him.
Well, it seems to me that they're fascinated, but it's maybe this process hasn't happened yet at that time, but they're fascinated, if you will, by a negative stereotype of the pagan Muslim man.
There's a lot of that going around, and evangelical Protestants of this period, of course, are doing their very best to ensure that old stereotype of Muhammad the imposter, Muhammad, this sort of sex-crazed, power-mad figure who is the stereotype from, you know, that dates from the Middle Ages. There are plenty of evangelical Protestants who are trying to sustain that caricature, that very negative image. But alongside of that, there is this competing image of Muhammad as the enlightened lawgiver. And there's plenty out there in newspapers and in lending libraries to offer Americans a competing image of the historical Muhammad.
We are talking right now with Professor Christine Heyerman about her book, American Apostles. Professor, how did you get the research, or how did you go about researching the topics for this book?
Oh, what a happy memory.
Spoken like a historian.
Yeah, a historian who's a real archive rat. Well, they're the biggest body of archival material on missionaries is up at Harvard at the Houghton Library. And our own Morris Library has this rich microfilm collection of many of the papers that are part of this missionary archive at Harvard. But I then discovered that I was particularly interested in one of these missionaries, a fellow by the name of Pliny Fisk, which is a great name for an early 19th century missionary. And I became interested in him because he struck me as so deeply committed, despite being an evangelical Protestant, to learning the truth about the appeal of Islam. And he was someone who was also very struck by the affinities between Christianity and Islam, and especially evangelical Christianity and Islam. So I was just smitten with Pliny Fisk and very curious about how he came to be the fellow he was. I mean, he's a quite ordinary, youngish, 20s, 30s farm boy from Western Massachusetts. And how he developed his curiosity and how he pursued it just came to fascinate me. It completely hijacked my imagination. And I discovered that some of his diaries were at Middlebury College up in Vermont. And I had assumed that these were simply copies of diaries that I had already read at Harvard. And so I called the guy who was the archivist at Middlebury, and he was very helpful. And he said, well, let me start to read you out of one of these diaries, and you can tell me if you've run across this information already. And so he starts reading to me, and it's Pliny Fisk explaining in a lot of detail what Muslim peoples made of same-sex relationships. And it was like nothing I had ever read before. And I said, I'll be right up. Just hold that document. Well, sure enough, there were voluminous diaries at Middlebury and more snuffling around and tracking down turned up the whole run of his diaries, which had ended up at Columbia University, at Union Theological Seminary, just the vagaries of how these manuscripts got sold off. And the very last time I went to Columbia, I thought I was just going up to check some quotations to make sure I had everything right. And I said, I'd like to see these two volumes. And they said, oh, well, have you looked at the third one? And it had been lost in the stacks. And all of a sudden, there was this third. So it was just, it was a historian's dream, just kind of coming upon all of these wonderful primary sources that nobody had really ever looked at before. And the private diaries at Middlebury and at Columbia were so much more intimate than, the kind of official reports that Harvard had. It was really a window into the mind of a man. It was wonderful.
The openness that Pliny Fisk had towards Islam was not shared by all the evangelical Christian missionaries. I mean, you describe one, Jonas King, who had almost the exact opposite reaction to his travels in the Middle East.
Exactly. King, too, is a fascinating character. And unfortunately, his private papers have disappeared from sight. But we do know a lot about the public persona that Jonas King created because he became a favorite of the missionary press, representing his daring encounters with hostile Muslim men, and King representing himself in turn as standing up courageously to these Muslim guys and winning their respect as he conducted debate after debate about religion with them. And so he styles himself as this kind of macho, heroic figure who strides across the desert dressed in Arabian drag. He has himself sketched wearing a turban with a full-length beard, every inch the equal of these Muslims who he is representing as his worthy adversaries. Have to be worthy so that his conquest counts for something.
Sounds like a rhetorical gunslinger.
Yes, exactly. In fact, you read his accounts of these encounters, and they compare very favorably with what will become, within a decade or two, dime novels that are written about the West. It's the same kind of blood and thunder stories because there are encounters with Muslim marauders and robbers that are also, very hostile and gripping in the same way that running into a war party of native peoples would be in these Western dime novels.
We're speaking today with Christine Heyerman, the Robert W. and Shirley P. Grimble Professor of American History here at the University of Delaware. And I think Allie had something she wanted to ask you.
With Fisk, he's all the way from the 19th century, but he's such a progressive thinker. You call him a seeker of faiths and an equal thinker. Why do you think, that was all the way in the 19th century, fast forward to present day 21st century, why do you think that evangelicals still have this obstacle to overcome with Islamophobia?
Well, that of course is a really interesting question. And every study that is done of negative stereotypes of Muslims. And the people in the United States today who are most likely to embrace those stereotypes, evangelical Protestants preponderate in the group that is most likely to have negative attitudes toward Islam. And the argument in American Apostles, and even now, 2 years later, I still think that this is right, is that Pliny Fisk very quickly figures out that his missionary sponsors back in Boston and the people who are editing evangelical newspapers are not interested in hearing his reflections on the many ways in which evangelical Protestantism finds an answering creed in Islam. They're not interested in hearing that, in fact, many of the conceptions that evangelical Protestants hold about Islam might be wrong. And so in a sense, he is being actively censored by his sponsors. But he also learns how to censor himself. It's very clear from his private diaries what he decides that he can't say because nobody will pay attention to him. And he is partnered with Jonas King, who is projecting an entirely different image of Islam, much more along the lines of what we think of today as kind of standard Islamophobic claptrap. And Jonas King has a huge audience. And evangelical Protestantism is deeply invested in presenting themselves as heroically standing up for Christianity in the Middle East. The image that King is presenting suits the objectives of evangelical Protestants very nicely. And I think we can understand this as part and parcel of the campaign of evangelical Protestants to dominate American culture and politics in the first half of the 19th century. And so in a sense, what happens is that Fisk's voice falls silent and Jonas King's voice fills the void.
You said that this was one of the things the evangelical Protestants were up to at the time was trying to have their point of view carry the day in government and in public opinion and even down to the laws that get made. And so one of the things I think is interesting that you talk about is how some of these young evangelical Christians like Pliny Fisk and Levi Parsons and Jonas King decide on proselytizing in the Middle East as opposed to going up to wild places like Vermont or the Western Territories where there are plenty of non-Christians and non-evangelical Christians that they could have tried to convert.
Well, you would have made the ideal evangelical critic of the 19th century because that's exactly what people who didn't like evangelicals very much, and there were plenty of them, had to say. You know, why not go and convert people in more remote regions of the United States that could use a Christian ministry? Why not go and minister to native peoples anywhere in the interior of the country? And the lure of a foreign missions for young evangelical men in this period, and it's really the best and the brightest who end up in the foreign missions movement. Less ambitious folks stay at home and minister to the poor benighted peoples of Maine and Vermont, or agree that they are go and work on missions for the Indians. The best and the brightest want to go abroad. And the Middle East is a particular draw because of the way that evangelicals understand the prophecies of the Bible, that the way that, in which they interpret the book of Revelation. And they are expecting the millennium, the return of Jesus Christ to earth, anytime soon. And they believe that that event will be accompanied with the conversion of the Jews and, of course, the destruction of both Roman Catholicism and Islam. And so they these young foreign missionaries see themselves as the shock troops of that destruction that will ultimately, quickly, they think, bring on the millennium. And so this whole superstructure of biblical interpretation is what is propelling them to not just to the Middle East, but to many different places. They think that they are in the vanguard of history.
I know this marks me as a liberal 20th, 21st century guy. I just don't get that kind of prejudice. I mean, if you just look at the words that are in English from Arabic, you know, algebra, Adobe. Yes, Adobe came from Spain via the Moors and down to the Southwest, and alfalfa and arsenal and admiral, average, azimuth, chemistry. Clearly, there was so much influence of Arab or Islamic culture on European culture, you know, before the European settlers came to America.
Sure. No, and I think that what's especially interesting is the way in which the Enlightenment and the scholars it inspires to do a serious study of Islam, the way that it fosters a counterimage, a completely, almost wholly positive counterimage of Islam. And the question is, why doesn't that counterimage take root and prevail? And I'm convinced that there was a real opportunity for that to happen, and that evangelical Protestants and their ambitions in the 19th century played a fundamental role in why that did not come to pass, in limiting the influence of this alternative.
What would you say your overall goal was for the book?
My overall goal was to get readers to realize that there could have been a different outcome. And especially, you know, I think that evangelical Protestants today generally don't realize the diversity within their own historical tradition on many points, on women's rights, on the rights of people who are in same-sex relationships, and with respect to Islam. And I was really hoping that people within evangelical Protestant churches today, who hold very different views of Islam than mine, would pick up this book and be influenced by it when they saw that within their own tradition, there is somebody like Pliny Fisk who represents an alternative way of approaching Islam.
Yeah, I mean, here we are in the 21st century in a global economy, but we've got militant parochial attitudes, you know, in a lot of different cultures about people who are different from us.
Right.
Air quotes.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, just as in the 19th century, here we are in the 21st century with politicians exploiting those mindless prejudices to pursue their political advantage.
This has been absolutely fascinating, Christine, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for coming down to Campus Voices.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Allie. Thank you, Richard. This was terrific.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.